Felicitas, welcome and thank you for joining us for the final session of the Teams Seminar podcast. Let me just start by saying that it's great to have you here again so we can talk a bit more about your ideas on the possible futures for education and technology. And I think everyone really enjoyed your conversation with Rihanna. So I think this after talk would be a nice way to expand some more on the ideas that were already discussed.
Thank you for inviting me.
Great. Let me start then with my first question. During the session, you presented briefly the three possible futures that you imagine in the article that you co-wrote. And I found this approach to education really interesting. And it made me curious to learn more about the story behind this article from your own point of view. More specifically, how have your academic background and interests resulted in the development of this article? And how did you become interested in education and technology more broadly?
Okay, those are a bunch of different questions. Really, thank you very much. It's nice to think about the story behind writing an article. My background is in strongly in discourse analysis and ethnography. And thinking together with the co-authors, we were thinking about what sort of discourses do we see in society at the moment? And what do we observe when we're observing schools or young people using technology and things like this? And like, right, we're seeing all this. Where does it go? What sort of futures are we could be developed out of actual practices that we see today? I've been long interested in a sort of critical discourse analysis, but then especially generative critique. Donna Haraway and Eve Sedgwick and a few other scholars, they talk about generative critique in the kind of sense of describing what could be possible or describing pockets of resistance or pockets of lines of flight which go to new places as a way of critiquing sort of dominant hierarchical societal structures of power and things like that. And so there was Neil Selwyn and Thomas Hillman organised a special issue here, specifically inviting contributions on thinking forwards into the 2020s. And we thought, how can we think into the 2020s without making something fictional? Because we can't say what's going to happen in the 2020s. We're not futurists, and even futurists can't really say what's going to happen. But the idea of thinking, imagining what could, if we take this pocket of discourse and practices that we see just now, scenario one, for instance, what happens in the future if that keeps going? And then this other pocket that we see, what happens if that keeps going? And this third pocket, what happens if that is extended and elaborated and becomes more dominant? Maybe another thing as well is about the fictional approach. One of the most powerful books I've read in recent years was from Peter Clough, writing about fiction in educational research. And it's an academic book that actually moved me to tears because it's so powerful as a way of presenting stories of what sort of does really happen, but fictionalized into shorter vignettes. Yeah. Oh, you also asked about education and technology. So my background was I did my PhD in journalism on journalism and how journalists write news, foreign news, etc. And I realised when I was looking at the production of journalism, okay, there's a kind of very strong profit motive. Journalism is a business, you know, with most of journalism. And when I'm looking at the production or the development of educational technology, educational media, there's a far more, for me, very interesting conflict between educationalists who are trying to change the world by developing materials. And also most of it is in a commercial for-profit area. And this was, for me, really interesting to look at how are educational media being developed, whether this is textbooks or now obviously more and more digital media are taking over the core role in education. So I wanted to look at how that's being developed.
Nice. Really nice to have this kind of background, like that, foreground how these ideas and like were manifested.
It's nice to reflect on it again. Thank you.
You mentioned like that for this article you were inspired by several books. You also mentioned now like Donna Haraway, Octavia Butler, that belong in this genre of a speculative fiction. So I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit more on how this speculative approach is useful within an educational context. Yeah, and what is the value of science and social fiction in developing research method and conducting research in a more broader scale, let's say.
Donna Haraway and Octavia Butler, Ursula K. Le Guin, these are just some of the sort of speculative thinkers that really inspired me or us, Heidrun Allard, Anna Bruch, also the co-authors, because they have, I don't know, I find very inspiring their way of thinking forwards, of trying to think differently, think otherwise about how the world could be. I love the way that Ursula Le Guin writes about writing, not only her fiction, but she's written a couple of books about writing and what it means to speculate and to create different worlds which are outside of our usual normalized discourses in which we live. Social science fiction, we also draw really strongly on sort of social science fiction in the sense that it's based on not really different methods or different approaches, but sort of the kind of ethnographic observations that we know, classic social science methodologies, discourse analysis, also classic sort of traditional discourse analytical methods, but thinking with speculative theory as in a set of spectacles to look with helps me to see something different in the data that I wouldn't normally see. When I look for, when I'm analysing discourses, I'm not just looking for the dominant, I'm looking for the fissures and the ruptures in those discourses, which maybe only appears one, maybe only a very marginal, or ethnography. We're looking for rich points. We're looking for those moments where something really surprising, unusual happens, even if it only happens once on one day in within 2 years of ethnographic observation. And in that rupture, in that fissure, in that line of flight, which goes somewhere, that speculative approach helps me to see that, to notice it more.
Yeah, so maybe in a way, could it be this idea that you're focusing also on the process of making things, not just like on the results, and at the same time challenging this traditional modes of knowledge production, saying, okay, you have this specific methodology and you're kind of expecting these results, but in your approach, you're, as you said, you're really trying to see the details and like, what are the things that you might have missed that could have meaning in the future or could have an impact? Like kind of maybe the butterfly effect that, okay, something very small could generate something.
Yes. And I really think it's really important for research to focus, for critical social science or critical humanities research, to focus on those moments, because we talk a lot about what could be and what might be, but it's actually already, lots of it is there, but we don't notice it because the social scientists, the researchers, we're not really looking for those, because that is often not the focus of research, and you don't see what you can't look for, you can't see. So in a sense, and there's a lot more research looking like this these days just now, but in a sense to say, for instance, economics is often taken, when people talk about economics, they often talk about capitalist economics, because that is the major form of economics in which we live. But there's lots of community economics and collective economics and shared economies going on, and there are now increasing scholars who are writing about that, obviously. But to look at those practices which are already happening, to foreground those, is also really important for social science humanities to do, I feel. Also data, there's a lot of critical discussion on data and education, datafication, how students are being tracked, and you know, the constant sort of using of our digital traces for capitalist product profit orientation, etc. But then there's increasing research now on data justice. It's still, you know, it's a small area of the whole research on datafication, but they're looking specifically at projects where data is used in a different way, is used in a way to further social justice projects, to lead to more equality, more ethical ways of being with data.
So in a way, it's kind of trying to bridge the old and the new, the old, let's say, problematics with the new problematics, because there are issues that we haven't even considered, especially with the proliferation of like the deification of education.
Yes. Yeah, and also I think that maybe this part of what this whole speculative approach, or also the ethnographic discourse, and this looking in at the ruptures and fissures approach, for me what it does is, you can say like one set of practices and discourses that I've been observing for a while, which were sort of more marginal, when it's about digital technology and education, was one where the social interactions are put in the foreground. where it's about relations and about interactions and about being together and communicating together. This was kind of more marginal because there was a much more focus on technology driven new hardware, new software, new AI, new exciting kind of tech things. And now, since the corona pandemic, when the schools have been closed, this discourse of social interaction, communication, finding ways to be together through technology, using technology for this sort of social, emotional, empathetic kind of ways, has become much more central, which I think is really positive and really exciting. But then it makes me say, okay, so where's the blind spot in that? Where do we now need to look as social scientists, humanities scholars, to find the next, you know, when that becomes normalized, what's happening and what is there that we need to critique there to make sure it keeps moving?
Could you provide maybe some examples of the specific ideas of like the social interactions that are now become more maybe visible?
Well, when the schools were closed now in many countries around the world, and a lot of teachers put in a lot of effort to find new ways to contact their students through digital technology. So the technology wasn't used anymore as a way to translate, like I had the blackboard, now I have the interactive smart board, mm-hmm. or I had the printed textbook, now I have the digital textbook, which are sort of the same practices, same education practice, same educational goals. Now they're saying, okay, wait a minute, it's about keeping the students involved in learning in some way or other, and keeping contact and checking in to see how are they, these students at the moment who are alone and trying to learn at home and under more or less pressure at home and learning alone. And a lot of teachers, not all, but a lot, have put in a lot of effort in finding ways to keep students engaged, like making challenges or shifting to a weekly plan or thinking of ways of formulating tasks and activities which are more explicitly linked to students' interests. One example I read was a teacher for politics had said, okay, your task is for this week, find a political issue which interests you, completely left it completely open, write down 5 or 6 questions, bring your family together in the evening, mm-hmm. and have a discussion round, like a panel, mm-hmm. like a TV talk show among your family members, and record it.
Yeah.
So, and then upload the recording to the school group chat thing. So the technology is there used for a completely new kind of activity. It's used to bring the family together to talk about political issues, and it's used to link the student with the teacher and share things with the among the classmates.
It brings this interesting dynamic between the individualization, let's say, of the of the educational method that you said, like now in this example that the teacher is trying to motivate the students in a different way, and not within a classroom, but okay, you're alone at home and you have to do something, but then it engages more the family aspect and the social aspect in a different context that is outside the classroom, but then enters the classroom in a differently.
Yes, exactly. And that's what I meant earlier, when you have to then start to ask, okay, what does it mean when the students are recording their family in their their living room setting? Is this video? What sort of transparency does that make when all the students see each other's family's homes, which they maybe didn't before? What does that do to students' sense of self and sense of agency and sense of inclusion, exclusion? You know, there's a whole bunch of new questions which open up when this kind of practice becomes more prevalent or starts to be used as well. And is it a difference if the teacher says, okay, record audio so that the visibility isn't there, or record video, and then you know there's a new sense of transparency and a new sense of the borders between school and family life becoming more porous?
Okay, then thinking again in this context, and this is digitized environment, I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about the role of the body in this format, because like you mentioned in the discussion an example for the example of the teacher giving the student a pencil, which might look like a very simple and negligible action that doesn't involve any cognitive learning, but there are very implicit yeah, things that you learn that have to do with the way that you're situating yourself towards another person, which I would say that this is like a different kind of embodied skill. And this, within the online classroom, this becomes more and more obsolete, or like it becomes a bit blurred. So I was wondering what's your approach of the body in this context.
Yeah. We talk a lot just now. We have a couple of projects where we're talking about post-digital practices. It just to sort of kind of capture what you've been describing there, in that at the moment, the world we have it just now, we're sort of all very connected. Even apparently unconnected people, someone that doesn't have a smartphone or deliberately sort of rejects technology or for various socioeconomic reasons isn't as connected, is still, as soon as you have a bank account, you are embedded in a connected layer of digital technology. Even if you yourself don't use the tech, the bank does. Or, you know, various things like that. We are embedded in series of digital networked connections and modes and nodes. But at the same time, there's nothing we do which is only digital. Even our discussion just now as audio recording, it also involves our voice, and the sound of the voice is a very physical thing as well. And I'm in a room on a chair with a computer, etc. You're somewhere else with rooms, chairs, physical surroundings. The sun's shining or the sun's not shining. It's all part of how we learn. I think the body question for me goes in two different directions, which are important. The one is there's quite a lot of research on embodied learning and how, you know, we learn through doing. Perhaps more or particular kinds of learning styles, and the tactile learning is one very powerful way of learning for many people. And especially if we're talking about younger children, or if we're talking about kids with attention deficit syndrome sort of questions, where it's moving is really important to learning. You can learn math through juggling and through moving and things like this. Mm-hmm. That's one aspect, is like learning cognitive subjects through movement, or learning non-cognitive subjects, how sport's very important, etc. But another whole area of where the body is important, and especially with the digital realm, is the idea of visibility or not visibility. What is seen? Which part of the bodies are seen and what's not seen? There's been a lot of discussion just now of homeschooling. When the schools have turned to digital, what happens to those one or two or three kids who are not connected, who don't have the technology, who don't have the video, the camera on the computer so they can join the video chat and be seen, or who are not there in the video conference that the school organises? These bodies have disappeared from the schools. Mm-hmm. And a lot of schools are doing a lot of effort to connect with those bodies. I know schools from our partner schools or schools we work with who then meet their students every week for half an hour. Even when the schools were closed and there was no contact, they met each individually at, 2 metres distance to hand over a package of printed out paper and to check how things are and how the family life is, etc. So they were trying physically using the body to get in contact to make sure there's still some learning going on. But at the same time, there's a very different kind of activity when you have 30 students or 25 or whatever in a classroom, and the teacher can see all the bodies and can see what they're doing, to when you have a chat where almost everyone's there but not quite, and where you're not sure why that other person's not there. And also, I saw an example last week of a student who renamed himself reconnecting ... so that he could withdraw himself bodily from that. I don't know what else he was doing at that time, but he was not engaging in that learning at that time. Those are important body questions as well. There's one example, I think I mentioned it in the other talk. I'm writing a paper with a colleague, Juliana Yarka, just now, in predictive analytics. And there's these predictive analytics tools, software for the schools, which try to include lots of different aspects of learning so they can predict whether a student is at risk. There's a very big at-risk discourse, which is in itself hugely interesting, whether a student's at risk of failing that year or having to repeat the year or whatever. And they bring in lots of different kinds of aspects. But one thing that this predictive software that we're analysing has is something called social learning. They call it social learning. And in that software, they they map a chart. They show you a nice little diagram with a dot in the middle of the students who are most interactive, and then all dots connected to each other. So the dot in the middle is most chatting most with other students. So they've got a really high score for social learning. Mm-hmm. And then you've got these other marginal dots, and you've got some, the dots in the middle are green because they're doing well, and you've got dots on the edges which are red because they're in trouble of not interacting enough with the other students. And this is, but what can a software capture? It can only capture the way students interact with each other within the software. It can't capture, like you said earlier, the pencil being given from the teacher to the student, or one student helping another student in the classroom bodily, physically. That is also social learning, but it's not captured in the software. So it's not part of the risk prediction score in the end. So what happens there? Do students learn then to not use their body so much, but to shift the interaction into the system so that their risk scores decreased and their, you know, success scores increased? Do they start to game the system in that way? And what does that do with their social interactions, their physical bodily social interactions, and their learning through other senses? Those are open questions that we don't have answers for yet. We need to observe what's happening when this predictive software is used in schools, which it isn't used very often yet, but it's being developed more and more.
Yeah, and I think this shows clearly, also mentioned in the discussion, this how the tools that we're constructing, how they have an impact on what is being produced, or whether that is knowledge or what is expected from the student to learn, or how to behave and how to perform. I personally, at least, I find it a very powerful kind of notion and a very interesting approach to see, okay, how can we maybe tweak these, or what are the underlying assumptions behind the tools that we're constructing, and what are the results behind that?
Yeah, this for me, this is, I think, almost the most fascinating question for me, is these underlying assumptions. Whose underlying assumptions are being engineered into the software that we are now using? The most discussion at the moment about digital technology and education focuses on hardware. Have the kids got it? Have they not got it? Is it being used? Is it not being used? How much is it being used? And this means that we're completely neglecting the question of the software. Who's engineering which into what into the software? How are the software engineers being trained themselves? What's part of their degree courses that they're using? Social and humanities observations of society are generally not at all part of their training. I know a couple of programs in Canada and the US now which are starting to include Indigenous knowledge as an important aspect of the training of software engineers, or there's a wonderful book by Sophia Noble which talks about algorithms of oppression, which talks also about the software. And if software engineers learn this and engage with that, lots of them are totally interested and really want to learn this stuff, but they're not exposed to it in their life and in their colleagues and in their degree training at all at the moment. So there's and we know that the cohort of people who become software engineers is very heavily a certain gender of white, etc., kind of middle class mix of people. So what kind of experiences of exclusion have they themselves ever experienced that they can then become important to them when they're making and designing software? I have one example. One concrete example, there's a storyboard that is a software tool which I've used in teaching a few times. It's a wonderful tool for making storyboards. Yeah, it has a whole bunch of background images and little figures and things, so the students can put in the characters and make their own stories. It's great for foreign language learning. It's also great for creativity and things like this. And to start with, like a year ago, 2 years ago, it had lots of different figures of images, and you could check. You could click onto the tab Teens, and you get a whole bunch of different ways that teens look. You click onto adults, you get a whole bunch of different adult icons. And you had to click onto culture to get the girl with the headscarf. And I thought, why is the girl with the headscarf not a teen? Why is she a culture and not a teen? And they've changed it. The girl with the headscarf is now a teen. So, there's a lot of change going on in this kind of software development.
Yeah, and it seems to me that it requires a whole lot of a different decision-making processes. Like, it kind of changes, especially in educational, political, and policy-making context that you also addressed in your discussion. So I was wondering, have you encountered, these difficulties in your engagement, maybe with policymakers? I'm assuming that you have. Is it safe to assume that you have some discussion based on your expertise on that?
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah. We've as and then one of the Leibniz Institutes, and as Leibniz Institutes, we do talk quite often to the policymakers or the politicians. The thing is that their focus is still at the moment very much on the hardware question in Germany. I'm involved with German policymakers, German politicians. Their focus is very much on the hardware question because there's a very strong dominant discourse in Germany that Germany is lagging behind and needs to catch up. And this lagging behind and needs to catch up discussion is very much focused on hardware. So that's very much central to the discussion just now, where I think in the current times of the corona and the things people have noticed while schools have been closed, this issue of inequality and exclusion through lack of hardware has become very prominent. And I hope that we can use our research to say, look, if you make this decision, then this might happen. And if you make this other decision, then that might happen. And think about it, if you say your goals are X, Y, Z, more participation, etc., then you're going to have to make this kind of decision and not that kind of decision. And that's across the board. There's no party, no political party, which doesn't say that increased participation and inclusion is not central. They understand that in a different way in their in how they want to translate that into practice, the different parties, whether it's a more conservative or more left-wing party, but it's explicitly a goal of all of them. And I'm not sure, I'm still working on how to bring the software question in to the policy making realm. One thing Germany has had strongly is that textbooks went through a process of being certified, and only certified textbooks could be used in schools. And the certification process looked at the pedagogical, the educational kinds of activities in it. And they also looked at the contents and said, this is a bit too ideological. That's not what we should be putting in textbooks. And now they're discussing in Germany, how do we do something similar for digital materials? But the number of digital materials is just massive. There's no way to do a certification process. And the whole point of digital materials is that they can be updated really quickly. Like the storyboard, that example, they can change it. If they had to go through the whole new certification process before they could put that online, that goes against everything that digital stands for. So, and there was one count, some researchers in Augsburg, they counted something like 983,000 different digital materials last year or something. The numbers are not quite right, but in that realm. So there's a question of how we can now engage with this, the contents of the software. Common Sense Media, sorry. There's a US website called Common Sense Media, where they have reviews of the digital material. So they can be ongoing, and it's a very useful source of, you can look up like any software, use Padlet or whatever, and you can see this is what they say about the content. This is what they say about the privacy, privacy regulations and all this sort of question. They're all embedded in these reviews. I think that's a good way to go forwards.
No, it's because I was also thinking, even the certification process has some assumptions that might not be in line with the material that you're asked to certify.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And you can see that very much an activist position has to come in to that as well. In the, I think, 90s, it became very important in Germany, the gender equality, and there was each textbook also had was specifically checked on the representation of males and females, and that was really important that happened in the 90s, and it sort of became a sort of ritual that you had to do specific things, but it was really important in that moment. And there's still no sort of diversity check or something in these textbooks, although there's been a lot of activism to try to bring that in as a really crucially important aspect of the content of textbooks, and of course of all digital materials then as well. How is the representation? Are these all white kids we're seeing with white German names? Or, what sort of different multiple transversal, kind of approaches are in these books?
Yeah. And like a very multi-level issue, and very complex. And I think like this idea again of like speculative fiction allows you to at least envision how this could plan out, with of course a high level of uncertainty, as I think all the problems that we're facing now are characterized by.
Yeah. I mean, it's always absolutely indeterminable. The future is not determinable. And no decision that we make today, we can say, okay, this is definitely going to be the outcome of that. Who knows what would happen next? What could happen next? We didn't plan in our fiction for anything radical like this pandemic which came. And now I ask myself, gosh, were we so naive to just think, just imagine everything was going to sort of flow smoothly in either one of these three directions, you know? But it's very smooth. I think if I wrote it again now, if we wrote it again now, I would definitely have some more, I don't know, some more significant rupture in maybe a fourth story or something. My hope would be that this sort of speculative fiction approach, this was only our first approach, our first try. I've tried something like this a few years ago, 5 years ago with other scholars on about discourse theory to try to make these concepts more accessible as well. But we're definitely not fiction writers. We don't come with skills of writing fiction, scholars generally. But I would really hope that the sort of speculative fiction or some sort of speculation or fiction kind of writing can make research also more accessible or more widely, not palatable, but more widely read by people who perhaps wouldn't normally want to read a straight, dry discourse analysis or from wouldn't normally read something from a journal.
Yeah. Great. I think these were my questions. Now, and this has been a wonderful, wonderful discussion. So thank you so much for sharing again all your thoughts on this topic.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure to think through it. Thank you for the questions.
Yeah. My pleasure. And again, I hope I see you again somehow in the future in a... Like in person?
Yeah, in physical.
Yeah, in physical. Yeah. Perfect. And have a good day. Thank you.